everyone. And I would like to dedicate this morning's talk to a Burmese monk named Usilananda. And he was the abbot of a small Burmese monastery in Half Moon Bay. And he died, I found out last night, he died last week. And he's been, he's taught here for us a number of times over the many years that we've been here in the area. And I first met him 20 years ago when I was getting ready to go to Burma to practice there. And he was living in Daly City then. And so I called him up and asked him if I could talk to him. And he said, sure, come on over. And so I went to see him in his little Burmese temple house, that was a temple in Daly City. And it was so remarkable to meet this man, because the feeling was that he was treating me as if we were old friends. It was very easy, very comfortable, just received me as if I was, you know, a good old friend, and just very open and present. And he's one of my little heroes in the Bay Area Buddhism. He came to America, I think partly to translate for the very, very famous Burmese meditation teacher named Mahasi Sayadaw, who systematized or kind of organized or created the insight meditation system that kind of we follow here at IMC. And this famous teacher, Mahasi Sayadaw, came in 79-80 to America with a little entourage. And when he came to San Francisco on his way back, they went around different places in America, and they last stopped San Francisco. He apparently turned to Usilananda and said, you should stay here. And so he stayed for 25 years. And he taught for many years all over the place. And taught retreats, and I sat a retreat with him in 1990. And a beautiful man, and a great scholar also. He was in Burma, he was known as being a great scholar of Buddhism, of Abhidharma. And he was kind of humble, so you didn't kind of know, when he was teaching here in America, you didn't quite know what a great man he was, and at least in his home country. And his funerals and burial and, well, not burial, but I guess funeral and cremation, and I thought they'd take his ashes back to Burma maybe, or somewhere. But what it says on the website is they're going to take and scatter his ashes in the Pacific Ocean. And but there's going to be a kind of a funeral event up in Daly City at some mortuary there, I guess, for a few days. But on Sunday is the main day. And from 4 o'clock to 9 o'clock on Sunday afternoon evening, there's going to be a viewing of the body, and it's kind of like his last teaching, because part of the tradition in Theravadan Buddhism is to do meditation on death, that meditation on dead bodies. So he's kind of offering himself. It's not so much like the wake where you go come and but he's kind of like offering, here it is, come and look at death. But also, for some people, it's kind of going, paying respects for this wonderful man. And if I can, I'll go up there and pay my respects, say goodbye to him that way. And the information is on his on the website for the, I think it's for the Tathagata Center in San Jose. It's called tathagata.org. And
I'll post a link on the website.
Yes, Inez will post a link to it. And so I want to dedicate this talk to him, whatever merit there might be in today's talk, to him, and my gratitude for having known him. And what I'd like to do today is to mostly tell an analogy. And hopefully the analogy makes some things kind of clear that maybe normally would be more complicated or difficult to understand. And I thought of this analogy, first we're teaching Sunday mornings in Potola Valley, and there was this huge linoleum floor that we sat on in this big auditorium. And sometimes we come in there Sunday morning and there'd been a party the night before and they hadn't cleaned up. And sometimes the beer was still on the floor and it'd be kind of sticky, and there'd be kind of, you know, dirt and stuff on the floor. So imagine that everyone who had a home that had the floor was tiled. Maybe beautiful 6-inch square tiles. That's what everybody had. There was a federal program to make sure everyone had beautiful tiled floors. And in 2006, we discovered that all the different cleaning things we use for cleaning tile floors were all terribly toxic for the environment, for ourselves. And so people just stopped cleaning their tiled floors because it was just too bad, too dangerous. And so no one cleaned. And so the beer built up, you know, and the dirt and the dust, and people just stepped on it and walked on it and kind of pushed it down. And you'd have the hot summer weathers, and you know, and we'd get caked and really hot, baked on there. And then people in the wintertime would walk in with the mud in their shoes and build up. And it went on like that for years, decades, centuries. And after 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 centuries, no one cleaning their floors, these wonderful tile floors, people forgot there was even tile down there, because the dirt is just building up. And maybe there's like, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 inches of dirt, you know, it's built up after a time. You know, if you go out to some of these archaeological sites in some places in the world, you can see, it's amazing how much the dirt has built up around these sites. So, you know, everybody's living with these 6-inch caked on solid, and people have just, in 500 years, they've forgotten that there was this beautiful tile at the floor of all these homes. And everyone's just taking care of their dirt, just, you know, just right. And moving it around and kind of arranging it a little bit and kind of just sweeping it and, you know, taking care of it so it's not too bad. But it's basically 6 inches of caked on dirt, dust and mud, spilled spaghetti sauce and things. And then someone goes down to the city hall and digs through some old, old paperwork and finds out, hey, back there 500 years ago, and they built all these houses in the peninsula, everyone had these tiled floors. And it says here they're really beautiful tiles. There's actually pictures of them, or there's, you know, something, you know, a description of them. There's descriptions of them. It's really beautiful. And this person goes around and tells everyone, and oh, you're crazy. You know, there's no tile down there. We've been living here for a long time, and we know there's no tile. Just, there's just these dirt floor. That's what, you know, everyone always has dirt floors. It's, you know, we can't have tile because it's, you know, too dangerous to clean them and stuff. So it's everybody's built dirt floors. That's what houses are built these days. And actually, late in a few centuries from now, people just build dirt floors because that's what they think is the style. They see all their old houses that have dirt floors. So, and so no one believes this person that that actually there's these beautiful tiles there. And the person is actually ostracized and, you know, dies a sad life. And then, but someone kind of gets wind of this rumor, that a little rumor that there's this these tiled floors. And someone who's maybe a little bit unusual in some way, maybe eccentric or has a lot of perseverance or who knows why, decides to try to really dig in and find out what's underneath that dirt. And it's a lot of work. And it's very interesting to go through the dirt. You know, it's really hard and caked on, and it just, you know, takes sledgehammer and what's it called? It's, you know, it's kind of sledgehammer, jackhammer, and, you know, it's all kinds of stuff, you know, that it's really hard work. And there are a few people who have tried over the years, but most people give up because it's just too hard to get through that dirt. And no one believes it's down there. It's tiles down there anyway, so they don't have the perseverance. So finally, it's very interesting to go through it. And what happens is when some people go through is they come to different layers. And sometimes you come to layers that are really hard and they say, this is impossible to go through. And sometimes they get to layers where, you know, in one century, they had, you know, they only had 3 inches of this dirt on their floors. But they decided to cover the floor with beautiful PVC. They had a lot of extra PVC. And so it was really beautiful PVC, you know, painted beautiful colors, and it was just very smooth and all that. And so sometimes they come down to the PVC layer, and this is great. This is what it was meant to be. I found it. This is what it really was. They were wrong when they called it a tile. It was really PVC. And it's it. And they make a whole, you know, it's a religion on the PVC. They worship it. It's great. This is like the best. In all these, you know, inherent goodness of all these homes. We found the PVC. So beautiful. And then some people find these layers where there were all these, you know, it was a frat house for a while, you know, for a few decades. And it just this awful stink and smell and, you know, just that, and, you know, there's vomit on the floor. They don't clean, right? So it really, this layer is just awful. And then some people write these books on philosophy about the awfulness, it's the essential nature of homes in the peninsula, because they come to this layer. There's nothing deeper than that. This is as deep as you get, this awful quality. But one person perseveres far enough and digs and digs. And right before that person digs all the way. And some people just they spend a whole lifetime digging and trying to clear, but they can't get very far. But some people decide there is no floor down there. But the process of digging is so great. And so they create a religion around digging. It's just the digging is where it's at, you know, just digging and digging and digging. There's no end to digging, but you just dig. And hence, you know. So but one person finally gets down to the tile and is able to clean out one square 6x8 tile. Clean it and polish it by the year 2500, they have the right cleaning agent. And so they clean this tile, and lo and behold, that person sees there is tile down there. Those old records were right. There is tile. Wow. And then, and this is kind of the important thing, the person realizes, you know, I found this little and square middle of this floor, this piece of tile that's down there. I bet it's a really good bet that the rest of this floor is also tile. And I can't see the rest of it, but I've reached the bottom right here, this 6 square inch. So I bet there's more tile everywhere else. Just a matter of clearing away the rest of the dirt and, you know, and doing the work. So the person realizes that in theory, it would be possible to clear out all the dirt on the floor in their house and have just beautiful tile again. But it's a lot of work, this dirt. So some people are just happy with having gotten down to one. They just know. It's good enough to know. And they forget about it and let the dirt build up again. But they know now what's down there. Some people said, you know, it's nice, but I think it's nice to kind of go clear out more. And so they spend their time clearing out more of the dirt and clearing more tiles. But maybe they don't have enough time in this lifetime to get all the way to the walls. But you could do 5, 6, 10 tiles or something in their lifetimes. It's pretty good. And some people's attitude when they realize this is very interesting, because some people, they see that one tile and they take a picture of it. And they make a badge of that picture and they put it on there and they walk around, you know, like, I got that one tile, you know, I found it, I know it, you know, this is the best, you know, and they forget about the house, they don't even go back home anymore, they just walk around the streets and they show people, And other people have cleared out the one tile in their homes. They are just really discouraged about how much more dirt there is. And other people clear the tile and they see all the dirt that's left to clean and say, this is a worthwhile thing to do, to be engaged in cleaning out the rest. This is a worthwhile thing. I think I'll engage. And they focus not on what the tile that's cleared out. That's not so important for them. They can almost forget it, in a sense. But they focus more on all the dirt that has to be done. And they go get new jackhammers and, you know, and pickaxes and wheelbarrows and whatever it takes. So they focus more on the process of cleaning more. And they almost forget the fact that. And as people start getting into this, realizing, you know, the word spreads that everyone has tiles on their floor, more people realize that it's possible, and more people then are willing to do the work and persevere and follow it all the way through. And more people catch on that you don't stop at the PVC layer. And you don't get discouraged at the vomit layer or the breath house thing. But you just carry on. And they discover that it turns out that different houses had different layers of dirt. And some people, for whatever reason, maybe they kept their front door closed a lot, they actually have not 6 inches of dirt, but they only have 3 inches of dirt, and it's relatively easy for them to get to the bottom. And for who knows what reasons, some houses have a foot of dirt. And for them, it takes a lot more. But they know it's there, so they just have to make more work, more effort to get there. But the tile's there for everybody. And so... in the Theravadin tradition that Yusilananda taught in, there is, it's possible to do the work of clearing out what in his tradition calls a lot the defilements. That there are various, they have all these words for the dirt. And a common word is the word defilement. Sometimes they call it the toxins, or the intoxicants, or the torments of the mind, the things that torment the mind. There's a variety of things. And no one knows how long it's been there and how many layers it's built up on, but the theory is that everyone has a certain degree of this gunk in their heart, in their mind. And this gunk is called the torments because it's those factors within this, our own psyche, which can torment us, can cause the torments, cause the suffering in our lives. And it's possible to do the work to clean up enough the mind to realize the innate purity that's available when the dirt is pushed away, when it is cleaned away, dug through. And that most people, the great majority of people, who do this work of cleaning the mind, doing this the meditation practice as taught in the Theravadin tradition, if they follow far enough, will get down to the tiles. We'll get down to the layer of the purity of the mind. And the first taste of it is kind of like just finding like one square tile of the floor. And then once you see that tile, once you see that you've touched the purity of the mind, the freedom of the mind, then you know by extrapolation, oh, in fact, if this is the baseline of what the mind is, in a sense, then now it's possible, I know in theory it's possible to clean the rest and clean it all out. And the Buddha is meant to be a person who's cleaned his whole floor, the entire floor. The entire mind. So there's no gunk, no dirt left in it. Whether there actually is such a person who's done that work completely, whether it's even humanly possible to do all the full work, is a religious question. It's an article of faith. And so, you can't point to any, there's no, human beings didn't come into this world with a manual that says, explains, this is how it is, really. There's certain things you can't really know, perhaps. And so it's an article of faith. But the Buddha at least represents its symbolic representation of the fact that in theory, the entire floor can be cleaned out. In theory, the mind can be purified completely. And if we had enough time to do it, and maybe our lifetime is not long enough to do all the work that needs to be done. And so, if you believe in many lifetimes, then maybe you can, you have a lot of lifetimes to do the work. Eventually, you could. But the Buddha either is in actuality, or is symbolically, or symbolically represents that possibility of doing the work. And so, for some people, it's very inspiring just the possibility that that's a direction we can take our life. It's possible to do the work of cleaning, of purifying the mind, the heart. And whether we can get to the end or not, clean the whole floor, is not as important as simply being engaged in the process of cleaning and opening and spreading that out as far as we can. In the Theravada tradition that Usulananda taught in, there are four stages to this cleaning process, four stages of awakening. And the first stage, when you finally see that one square tile, is really the important aspect of that has to do with understanding. Understanding what's possible. Understanding that really there is this possibility of this clean floor. Really there is this process of cleaning that works, and this is the process of doing it. That there is, and so there's no more any doubt. So those three things, those called three knots of the mind, are dissolved when you finally get down to the bottom floor. There's three pieces of crud. The first crud is the doubt that there is a floor or not a floor. Some people get so caught up in the doubt that they don't spend any time cleaning, they spend all the time in the library. And some people, that's one, is doubt. The other is, related to that, is not knowing what the real practice is. What's the practice that really takes you to the bottom? And some people think that if you just simply dance on top of the dirt floor enough and make offerings to the floor god, that's going to do it. But when you see that actually that doesn't do it, you have to actually do the digging work yourself and actually excavate and clear out. And you actually see this is the practice. There's a particular practice or way of practicing that can help you reach the purity of the mind. And there are other things which are not going to help, no matter how religiously they might seem, how religiously inspiring they might be. And then the last one is actually seeing it, knowing, you actually see the tile, you know, this is the tile, is in the Theravada tradition, is to have this understanding that in the purity of the mind, nothing makes any sense to take personally. To realize something about it, something very powerfully and liberating and refreshing about seeing something about the impersonal nature of the mind, of the heart, of our experience. So that's a whole thing in itself to discuss, that why they talk about the impersonal nature. But when you see that's the first tile, you're no longer liable to hang on to something in a personal way. It kind of helps use this thing to define, this is who I am. And a lot of people get defined by the dirt, different layers, the PVC, that's who I really am. And or this is who I really am. This is who I am, different things. Or the vomit layer, that's who I really am. And the idea is, none of that's you. And the kind of paradox is, once you get down to the tile level, any attempt to take the tile as being who you are is like, makes the tile too slippery to stand on, you fall down. So you can't even take the purity of the mind as being, this is who I am. So you realize that you can't personalize anything. And it seems very odd, people never heard this kind of, but you've probably heard in many spiritual traditions the idea of your ego has to die if you're really going to become awake. Something and some tendency to hold on to ego or self-identity has to be dissolved as part of the dirt. And that first tasting of the tile is to see through that. You might still have a tendency of personalizing things, identifying, but now you really know the fiction it is. You know something else. So then once you see that, then the question is, what do you do? When you see the purity of the mind, the freedom possible in the mind. And some people will be contented with that and not do anything more from that. And some people will say, oh yeah, now I've seen what's possible. Now I really know what the work is. Until then, you didn't really know what the work is. There's some idea in Buddhism, at least, that the first taste of awakening shows people. It's only then that you really start practicing Buddhism. It's a little bit discouraging, but that you have to wait until then. But it makes sense because only then you really know what the work is all about. Until then, it's supposition, your book learning, it's ideas you have, and so now you really know what it takes in order to, you know, to walk the path of liberation. And then, as different people in different parts of the peninsula here get into digging through their floors, there's all kinds of interesting different little sectarian differences that arise. And some people just see the dirt as dirt, no matter what it is. PVC, vomit, just all dirt, just all get rid of it. You know, it's all the enemy, it's all just get rid of it. And some people see it as the dirt as being, you know, the dirt is very interesting. And, you know, if you kind of chip it out in a certain way, it's so hard. You don't have to buy pickaxes. It's pickaxes inherent in the dirt in the floor. So rather than being quick to get rid of things, you just have to learn how to use it, how to chip it free, and then you can use part of the dirt to break up more dirt. And some people find out that that if that if you are really present for some of the spots of dirt, some of the layers, just really present right there for it, and just sit there like a chicken sitting on its egg, you know, keeping it warm, that somehow that your own body heat starts to kind of melt that particular layer. And as it melts, it becomes this wonderful liquid that helps dissolve the layers below. And so it's kind of like making compost, you know, it's kind of like you're taking something, you don't see that it's the enemy to get rid of, you see it as something to kind of transform, so they can help you do more work. And some people see the possibilities of, you know, kind of engaging the dirt just right and kind of being very kind to it. You have to be kind to it and for it to melt just right, right? And so in different parts of the peninsula, they have different ideas about how you relate to the dirt. Some people just get rid of it. Some people celebrate it and sit on it and let it dissolve and it melts and everything. And some people, you know, are more, you know, utilitarian, you know, or whatever. And they just focusing on how to get, chip it free and get, you know, these sharp pickaxes and, you know, different approaches to how to work with the dirt. So the same thing with the mind. You find in Buddhism different attitudes towards the stuff of the mind. And you find some people who just see just, it's all bad. It's all defilement. The defilements are just defilements. That's all. You just call it for what it is. Defilement of the mind. Dirt of the mind is dirt. That's what it is. And let's just get rid of it. And other people have more creative ideas about the stuff in the mind that obscures the possibility of seeing the beauty of freedom. And some people will take that, understand a little bit of how to work with that dirt, so the dirt actually becomes a tool, or the dirt actually transforms itself into something that supports the whole process. And so there are different, you know, sectarian views or ideas in Buddhism also. And sometimes people make religions around their views. And so that gets very interesting. You know, this is the right way, this is the true way. It's only dirt. It's only, you know, it's compost it all. It's all to be transformed. And there's even some people who will go to the really into going to their neighbor's house and helping them, and they carry the dirt back to their house. So that, because they don't really, it's not so important that they get to the bottom of their floor, but they really want to help the other people. And so they spend their time helping other people and carry the dirt, and they, you know, and their floors get higher and higher. And they're just hoping that the neighbor's house gets clean before they get to the, you know, ceiling. So. So I thought of telling you this because the other day I had a walk with a person who had asked another Dharma teacher if anybody in America gets enlightened, has gotten enlightened. And the person apparently said something like, never met anyone. And so maybe the person hasn't met anyone, it could well be. But I think there are a lot of people in America who have seen that square tile. And lots of people. And then, but how many people have cleared away two tiles or three tiles or four tiles? That, I have no idea. But it's, you know, so people have, you know, it's possible to reach that one tile. And some people find that very encouraging to know that there are people who have done that. And sometimes you meet people who have practiced for many, many years, you know, very senior, great masters, and you get a sense meeting them that there isn't much dirt left on their tiles. But maybe some. You know, you don't know how much. It's hard to know sometimes. Some of these great teachers are kind of inscrutable. And they really let on. And so it's really easy to project. They've done. There's no dirt in their tiles at all. I'm sure of it. It's hard to know these things. A lot of things is hard to know. But it's possible to know that there's tile down there. So I hope that each of you has scratched the surface. And in scratching the surface, feel inspired to kind of do a little more work and clear the tile. And it's something that's really worthwhile doing. And it's really, really the world needs people who have tasted the purity of the mind, that freedom of the mind, that place where suffering is brought to an end. So, your chance, your turn. What would you like to ask? We have a few minutes if you want to ask some questions or have some comments.
If you raise your hand, I'll get you the microphone so that people with hearing assisted devices can hear you.
Suppose the digging just results in more defilement. Like, how do you dig without accumulating more dirt?
Oh yeah, there's some people who are really good at digging, but they take a shovel and they dig in, and then they just throw it over their shoulder. And they get down a little bit, but then they turn around and they realize, wait a minute. And then, you know, it's so discouraging, you know, to realize that you're just putting it behind you. And then some people start crying. And then the tears drop down, and the tears kind of crystallize all the dirt that you loosened. And then the wind blows more dust in and builds up even more. And, you know, it can be very, very hard sometimes. So, how do you know? If you are, I think one of the ways to know is that you have to have some real clear sense that this is valuable to do what you're doing. So you have a sense of the valuableness of it, that then it becomes clear that you're not wasting your time. Also, if you have to look very carefully at how you engage in the practice to make sure that the way you practice doesn't have suffering as part of it, or clinging as part of it. Is a person clinging or pushing or demanding? Is a person have beliefs about themselves which is weighing them down as they do it? I can't do this, or it's impossible, or I'm so inherently bad, or all kinds of things, you know, which are forms of suffering. There should be some sense or some intimation or some hint that you're moving in a direction of ease, of freedom from suffering. Now, I know sometimes you run through the vomit layer, and so it can seem like it's, you know, getting worse, but really it's getting better. But sometimes it does get worse, you know, depending on, I know people whose attitude towards practice is so self-defeating. Sometimes talking to a teacher is very helpful so you can get clarify, find out what you're doing. One thing that's sometimes helpful is if you take your awareness and turn it 180 degrees around to look at the quality of your effort, So people are making effort in practice. They're focusing on trying to do something, in a sense. And they don't really notice the quality of the effort behind what they're trying to do. And if you turn the attention 180 degrees around and look at the quality of the effort, if that quality is tight or constricted or afraid or greedy or ambitious or something, somehow contracted, then probably you're just kind of, you know, not making any progress. But if you turn around and look at that quality of that effort and then begin clarifying that, relaxing that, that should help a lot. Is that the suggestion? Yes.
Does anyone look beneath a tile?
The tile analogy doesn't quite work so well for the mind, because when you get to the tiles of the mind, there's nothing there. So there's nothing underneath. Yes?
I've asked this before, so I apologize if I'm kind of stuck on something like, why should being in the moment reveal the tile? I'm lost on that one.
I think being in the moment by itself doesn't necessarily reveal the tile. Bank robbers are very much in the present moment, and it's more than some of us when we meditate. I mean, they got to be. and sometimes, and the question is a fair question, because sometimes in American Buddhism, the present moment is held up as kind of like a god. It's like everything's about the present moment, just being present. The present moment is the door towards awakening, but more is needed than just the present, just now. But there's a door. So you have to get to the present moment in order to do the work to go deeper. It's like, you know, if you're sitting on your living room couch thinking about clearing out the floor tomorrow, and the next day think about it again tomorrow, you know, that's not going to do any work. If you spend your time thinking on the couch, thinking about all the time you should have been doing it in the past, I should have started when I was 10 years ago, then nothing's going to happen. But you have to realize that the work has to happen now. The digging has to happen now. So you have to start in the present moment. So, and then you have to have a wise relationship to the present moment. What's the way to be in the present moment that's wise? And one of the ways is to begin looking more carefully. There are many things to say about this, but one of the ways is to begin looking more carefully at the present moment. So as we're in the now more and more, there's some powerful things that begin to happen. One thing that happens is that all the phenomenal tendencies of the human mind not to be now become, you start letting go of them. And many of the ways we suffer have to do about, occur when the mind is not in the present moment. And so when we're just when really in the present moment, a lot of the suffering of human life begins to fall away or soften. And that helps a lot. The less suffering you have, the softer the floor becomes. But then as you're able to stay in the present moment more, then you need to look more carefully at the present moment and look in a way that helps you to dig, helps you to look more carefully at what's really going on. And that's when we get instructions in mindfulness practice, where there's directions of where to look and how to look and what's most useful to look at. And there's a whole bunch of things to do. So now by itself is not so easily going to get you to the tile. But if you relate to the now in the right way, then it'll get you to the tile. Is that satisfying enough?
It is.
Not satisfying to me, but if it's satisfying to you.
A little bit. Yes.
Okay. Yes. I'll be back.
I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the four, starting with doubt, the four
stages
so there's, of difficulties.
There's four stages to awakening. And it's basically you take that the big floor of yours in your house, and you say you have four, four stages to cleaning out the floor. There's the first stage, which is basically finding one square tile. And then there's the next stage, which is doing a quarter more of the work. And the next stage was doing a quarter more of the work. And then the last stage where the whole floor is clean now. And the first one is more cognitive, has to do with understanding. When you finally see the tile, the primary transformation is cognitive. Your understanding changes, and no more doubt. And you know now what the practice is all about, what the practice is, and you understand the nature of this tendency to take things personally. So you understand, you're no longer fooled by the mind's tendency to grab onto things. This is who I really am. So it's all cognitive. The cognitive layer of the mind, how difficult it is to get to that layer, is easier to get to than the following layers, the following aspects of the floor. And so the next stage is you don't actually remove all the dirt. The next stage, but you get rid of most of it, a lot of it. So you're thinning it out dramatically for the next part of the floor. And this has to do with affective parts of our psyche, the emotional sides more, and which are harder to get to than the cognitive, the rational. And so you have to find some way to get down there. And primarily it has to do with sensual desire, which is a huge part of human life, affects human life broader than most people think. Sensual desire and ill will. And so the second layer, stage of enlightenment, sensual desire and ill will are abated quite a bit, weakened quite a bit, but not eliminated. The third layer, sensual desire and ill will, have been uprooted, have been cleaned out completely. So that's not a problem anymore. At the fourth layer, there are five other pieces of dirt. They're called, the tradition calls them knots or entanglements that need to be cleaned out. And the theory is that these five get cleaned out altogether. So it's not like you do one at a time. And two of them have to do with certain kinds of clinging to what may be called, from the point of view of street consciousness, altered states of consciousness. Because people who do meditation practice or do spiritual practices will often have, you know, spiritual experiences, mystical experiences, altered states of consciousness kind of experiences, experiences of infinite consciousness, all kinds of different ways of experiences. And it's very easy to get attached to those. They're can be quite pleasant, quite wonderful. And so, but clinging is just more dirt. And so, so at this fourth layer, two of the five things that get cleaned up is clinging to altered states, mystical states, spiritual states. The third is conceit. And whereas in the very first stage, you understand that it doesn't make any sense to take anything deeply personal, this deep kind of deep identification. But the tendency to conceit still operates. There's a tendency for the psychic, the idea of the intuitive sense of the mind, I am, you know, is still operates. It's very subtle, but that I am, the clinging to a sense of I am-ness, for example. So the conceit still operates. So the clinging to conceit is eliminated, is cleaned out. And then the fourth is restlessness. That restlessness is so deeply kind of ingrained in the psyche that it's one of the last things to be eliminated. A very subtle form of restlessness in the mind, in the heart. And then the fifth is ignorance. And it says that even though you've seen something at the first stage, there still remains some very deeply ingrained misunderstanding about reality, about life, that is eliminated at last, at the very end. So four stages. Does that make sense? That's the way the tradition offers it. And some people will go through, supposedly, you know, in a progressive way. Some people seem to have the capacity of just dropping, you know, doing two or three stage, four stages all at once. Different people, you know, have different thicknesses of dirt on the floor. So I hope that this analogy was helpful to understand something about this Theravada tradition, how it understands practice. And if it was not helpful, then you should not take, if it wasn't helpful, you should not use that as an occasion to add more dirt to your floor. So, thank you very much.